when disaster strikes. Will you be ready?
Good evening, and we begin tonight with the monster hurricane and its deadly impact already.
When all hope is gone, will the government be there for you? If you're looking for ways to take your prepping to the next level, then you've come to the right place. Broadcasting from a secure and well-prepared location, it's time for Prepping 2.0. And now, please welcome authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Welcome, everybody. This is the one everyone's been waiting for, Special Forces Ted, the real dude, the real Special Forces Ted, for reals with a Z, which means you know it's really real. And we have him on the line. We told him off air, hey, we're just going to record all we can, as much time as you have today, and we might have two episodes. There will be an after show component to this, so some really good stuff will be on the after show. But you know, first I need to introduce my co-host, Shelby Gallagher. Hello, Shelby Gallagher.
Hello, how are you, Mr. Tate?
I'm just fine. I'm married to you, so I'm just fine.
Okay, so that makes you Glenn to me now. Okay, I'm just checking.
So let's just kick it off and let's introduce Special Forces Ted. Special Forces Ted, say hello to the people.
Hello, everyone. How you doing?
See, he's real, everybody. Anyway, we wanted to ask you, I know the answer to this, but the listeners want to know, can you give a brief overview of your background, and that will start things off?
Yeah, so my background's pretty simple. I grew up in a small town in the Midwest, joined the military right out of high school, spent my first 5 years in infantry, and transitioned to Special Forces, spent 17 years in Special Forces, and I just recently retired. So that's a pretty broad stroke overview.
And yes, and I know from knowing you that one of the things you did, and we'll talk about this more in detail in Special Forces, is the core Special Forces mission, which is leading, training, working with local partisans and in insurgents and all of that. So you have credibility, is my point, when it comes to what you talk about. Well, what I talk about through you, basically, in the books. So you've done this stuff. You weren't, you know, at the Pentagon sitting at a desk.
That's correct.
Yeah. So talk about how you became part of the book. And by that, I mean, I wrote you into the book, and you were a major character in the books. Start off when you came to JBLM, which is Joint Base Lewis-McChord in the Tacoma, Washington area. Met Chip, started hanging out at Capital City Guns. Just kind of give an overview of how that went.
So I first got to JBLM in early 2000s, 2002 timeframe. I think I first met Chip in 2003 when he was part of another gun store. And we hit it off right away. Deployment started coming pretty quick. And I didn't really reunite with Chip until about 2006 or so. At about 2006, I had a little bit of downtime because my wife was going through some issues at the time, medical issues. So I would spend a lot of my free time when I wasn't at home at the gun store, learning from Chip. He'd show me how to build ARs, and, we would go through different types of guns, and I'd teach him things. He'd teach me things type of stuff. And, our friendship just grew. Eventually we'd be going to each other's houses, and I'd have my family to his place and vice versa. And we just had a really good friendship.
So in the books, I talk about people coming by. It sounds like a Special Forces ninja dog. Sounds like that's what that is.
Yeah, in the background. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. I would ask you your dog's name, but I'm sure that's classified. But we would have people hanging out at the gun store. Describe sort of the milieu, a French word. I like to lace things with French words because I feel.
I love it.
Thank you. Or merci, should I say. But describe the vibe at the gun store, because when I wrote in the books that people would drop in and work on some ARs, and I describe myself, here I am a lawyer and a lobbyist. I walk in with a suit and maybe some donuts or some chicken, and feed folks and we'd hang out. And it was like a barber shop. I described it in the books. And I'd roll up my sleeves and start working on ARs just for fun. People think that's unusual. I don't think it's unusual because I lived it and you lived it. But just describe what a day was like when you'd go to Capital City Guns and hang out with Chip.
Yeah, that's just it. I think every day I walked in there could be a little different. But one thing you could always expect is to see Chip and his smiling face. And he'd always have a story for you. And he'd always be willing to help you address whatever problems you had that day. And it was kind of like a coffee shop or a bar without beer type environment. And you'd always have just random characters coming and going that were, you know, really great to get to know. A lot of really friendly people and interesting people from all walks of life. And I felt it brought the community together through guns and through fellowship. It was really good.
Exactly. You've captured it. And I'm glad you did, because people thought I was making it up. And obviously I did some literary license and kind of connected gaps with facts that I made up to make things connect. But it really was like that. Have you ever experienced that at another gun store, or heard some of your guys who are from all over the country, all over the world, really? Has anyone ever said, oh, yeah, that's like that gun store when I was growing up in Wisconsin? I mean, is this a rare thing or somewhat common?
No, it's very unique. I think it had a lot to do with Chip's personality and the way he would just bring people around. He was like a magnet, just drawing people to him. And he set up an environment that was just very welcoming and inviting people in.
Yeah, exactly. I remember this. Some of the guys in group, which is the first Special Forces group, so your unit, would also come. A few of them would come and get guns there. It seemed like, I remember Chip would always be ordering special stuff for you guys that you guys couldn't get through normal supply chains. And I assume you guys were paying for it on your own, because I know you had to do that, especially in the 2000s, before I think Special Operations was as well funded as it ended up being maybe in the second half of the 2000s. So I remember Chip would be there. It's like, you guys needed X, Y, and Z, and he would go and he'd get it. I know he was selling guys stuff at cost and that kind of thing. Was he kind of your side armorer in a sense? Was he doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. He was my go-to guy. There was only, at the beginning of the war, everything was pretty much standard issue military equipment. And we did have the leeway to modify whatever we felt necessary to help us achieve our goals. So, you know, free-floated barrels, specialty triggers, whatnot. If we did that was pretty much on us. And Chip was my go-to guy when it came to getting things at a wholesale price or helping us install a specialty part or something like that. And he extended it to pretty much anyone in the military that walked through the door. But especially with First Group, the people that I worked with, we definitely got, you know, wholesale price and anything we asked for, pretty much.
Yeah, I remember that. Guys would come in and most of the time you guys would remove your berets when you were in uniform and I believe put them in a cargo pocket, you know, not to stand out or anything. And of course you're undercover, so you would take your beret off. And I remember seeing those and he introduced me to the term green beanies. Those are the green beanies. And and you guys just blended in. And one of the things because I've been around, and obviously not a military guy, I'm not claiming to have like coolness by association or anything, but I've been around guys like you and others in that community, and the unassuming, modest nature, I mean, unless you've experienced it and seen it, you really wouldn't believe it. It's not like TV. It's not like you guys are SEALs where you're like, hey, check it out, I'm a SEAL. No, I'm just kidding. Kind of true, actually. So it was always fun to watch just these very polite, mild-mannered guys getting their stuff and thank you, sir. And it was a really cool experience. And let's go back. I mean, it was the mid 2000s and we were in the middle of a couple wars. Of course, there was a little bit of a war in the Philippines, too, which Abu Sayyaf, off the top of my head, and I know that First Group was out there, too, and that kind of gets forgotten. But anyway, there's some wars going on, and guys at JBLM were in the thick of it, and it was, I don't know, kind of a little bit of service to your country to be able, like Chip was doing, not me, to be able to help with this stuff. And it just was really, really cool. What did you think, a random thought, what did you think living in the Olympia area? Is that a left-wing wacko place or what?
Yeah, so when I first moved there in 2002, you know, it's always been, you know, definitely a leftist area. But I think that it didn't become as extreme as it is now until later on. I would say probably middle of the surge or so, or at least that's when the nut jobs really started coming out of the woodwork. But you know, we're trained to assimilate with areas that we go to and kind of just, you know, maybe not adopt, but adapt to where we live to, you know, make friends with the locals and try to at least understand the culture and navigate through it. And that's just one of those things we had to do in Olympia as well, because you could definitely, you know, go to areas that you didn't feel welcome or didn't want to be because, you know, it's just not your scene. So, yeah, it's definitely a culture shock from North Carolina.
You know, and I just now put two and two together. I can't believe I didn't realize this until now. Yes, you're trained to say you're in Afghanistan and you are part of the local tribal culture. And there's, what did you guys call it? The goat circuit or whatever, where you go around and have like meals with the tribal elders. And you're like, right. Yeah, it's delicious. Curry, rice, and goat. Well, I can't get enough of this. And then you kind of had to use those same skills, not maybe skills, but the same attitude, the same adaptability in Olympia, Washington. That is so telling. I miss America, Ted. That's what that tells me. Jeez.
You and me both, sir.
That's right. Oh, and that's one thing. If you haven't figured it out, listeners, by now, Ted is a real patriot, and that is a big factor in all this. So we're not just talking to a guy who's like, yeah, I was in the Army. I did some stuff, ate some goat, you know, got some specialty triggers at this gun store. No, he's the real deal on that. So now you were deployed. Now I'm going to ask you a little bit about your career in the Army, and I understand that there are some places that you were that you weren't, right? I mean, you're not going to talk about, and that's totally cool and understandable. But paint a picture for folks about some of the experiences you've had in the special operations community and places you've been that allow you to look at what collapses look like and what disruptions of normal services and society falling apart, you know, what it looks like. So maybe don't name the countries, but just tell us what you've seen out in third world bad places. And I think that's something that regular people don't know, guys like you, don't get to hear these things. And we think America is the center of the universe, and it's not. So just, I mean, and this is story time. Just tell us all kinds of stuff about bad stuff in bad places.
Right. Well, first of all, I do want to say that America truly is the land of milk and honey. And there's no better place on the planet than America. United States of America, that is. With that said, having served in First Special Forces Group, I had the opportunity to not only just go to the combat zones, but also deploy to Southeast Asia, all around Southeast Asia, and experience that culture as well. And anywhere from the Himalayas to, you know, areas in the Philippines to, you know, Thailand, places all around there. And then, of course, everyone gets their trip to the sandbox, but you know, just different societies, definitely from the way that they view the world, you'll see the way their society acts, and the way they treat their children, the way they treat their women. All these things are very relevant in individual cultures. Yeah, but I can say, like, being in Bangladesh at one time, you'll notice that there's a whole begging class that people literally mutilate their children just so they can be better beggars. And we wrap our heads around that, you know, as Americans. You know, when I first saw it, you know, I almost threw up. It was disgusting. And it enraged me to see these children like that. But I mean, stuff like that. It's very, very telling of, you know, poor countries, poor people, and, you know, just what we consider part of our moral fabric. You know, other people, either they don't have that, or they go past it just to make a little money, and it's just devastating.
Well, and tell us about either some places where there's been a lack of government, or then other places where there's been too much government in the sense of authoritarianism. I mean, the different levels and habits and customs of government in the places you went. What can some regular Americans sitting in the suburbs listening to this, what can they learn from all of that?
Well, I can think back to Nepal. We were in Nepal for a while, and there was the active civil war going on in Nepal for about 10 years from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. And we would go there and train the Nepalese people. And there was a Maoist insurgency, and you would notice that the Maoists actually had more control and more credibility than the actual government did at times. And they called them bonds. And basically, there were protests or strikes that they would just initiate. And it would be like, hey, on Thursday, everyone will close down their shops. And if you don't close down your shop, you're going to be firebombed. And literally, that's what happened. And looking at the Nepalese government now, you'll see that the Maoist ended up winning. So, I mean, that's definitely one thing to think of. And then, I mean, like places like Afghanistan. I mean, there's an Afghan government on paper, definitely. But I also do believe that really the government is tribal. And, you know, it's the shadow government that really has the say-so when it comes to the outskirting, you know, villages.
In shadow government, that is a term I love, because it's where I think things are going to go. And by the way, as you know, because you've read the books, and everyone who's read it or listened to the books knows, I don't think there's going to be a one-size-fits-all scenario for the United States. Is that something you agree with? Do you think it's going to be different based on where you are after the collapse?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be very regional. I've heard people kick around the idea of the balkanization of America, and I'm not quite sure how that would play out, but I'm quite certain that it's going to be different, you know, on the East Coast than it will be on the West Coast.
Right, and of course, it's going to vary with resources. I mean, if you're in Texas and you've got oil in your own electrical grid and farmland and access to seaports, that's one thing. And if you're landlocked in, Vermont, it's maybe going to be different. You mentioned tribalism, and that's one of the things that I think most Americans don't grasp, and I don't think I fully grasp it either. What is tribalism, and what does it look like? And do you think it will pop up here in some post-collapse scenarios?
So what is tribalism? It's like a very local form of government, I guess you can explain it as. And it can transcend through neighboring cities, but basically it would be people from a surrounding area that all follow a certain code or are under a certain rule of thumb, if you will. Not everyone may agree with the tribe's rule, but, you know, if they have the might, they will enforce their will, you know? So, yeah, yes. And do I think that this could happen post-collapse? Yeah, absolutely. There's, with absence of governmental power, there's going to be another form of power that will take place. So, yes, warlords will happen, and tribal leaders will, you know, definitely rise to the top, whether it's a community leader or the lead gang member in the area. It's hard to say.
See, and that was my next question, and that was, when we hear tribalism, we think, and I'm a member of an American Indian tribe. Of course, my Indian tribe is mm-hmm. is a lot about, going to church and rooting for football because it's an Oklahoma thing. So there's not much tribe, right? I mean, it's more like a high school football team allegiance than it is anything else, which is good because then people aren't killing each other. So I'm all for that. But our tribes, when people hear that term, I think a lot of people assume, oh, it's going to be all of the Norwegians. But I just think that's crazy. I mean, is it always racial and ethnic, or what are some common denominators that tribes end up coalescing around?
So, I mean, in the places I've been throughout the world, I would say, yes, generally speaking, it is an ethnical thing where, you know, a dominant race or culture in that area would definitely take over and oppress the others that are less in numbers or less in technology. With that said, in America, I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think it's going to be the Norwegians versus the Italians or anything like that. I think it's going to be people more of a similar mindset, ideology type of thing, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes a ton of sense, because we all can foresee sort of our side, our tribe being the conservatives, libertarians, whatever. This isn't a political show, but you know what I mean. Like that kind of self, the patriots. There's the best word for it.
Sure.
Do you think that what do tribes on the other side look like? I mean, could Antifa have tribes? Could there be other kinds of tribes that aren't really ideological in America?
Well, I do believe Antifa is a form of a tribe. Absolutely. I mean, they, if you ask me, they're the action arm of a insert movement in America right now, if you want to look at it that way. But I think that groups will form their own rules, their own set of rules, and their hierarchy of chain of command, if you will, throughout the areas. And it doesn't really matter, you know, exactly where you're from necessarily, but, you know, who you are and what you provide, what you bring to the table, and that will give you status within that group.
Exactly. Is that what you're doing with that? Absolutely. And it's, I hate to just like agree all the time with you, but yes, that is exactly. And see, it's exactly how I see it. And this is the kind of cool thing about that conclusion, that this is what we think it's going to look like. And we could be wrong, by the way, is that you come at it from a military and an experience standpoint where you've seen this. I come at it from no experience with this, almost theoretical in a sense. But I mean, I get gangs. It sounds odd for most people to hear me, and they're like, "Oh, you're like a Seattle area lawyer. What do you know about gangs?" But I know how politics works, and politics is the nice side of gangs. There's a group mentality. There's you know, getting jumped in, if you will, right? There's
sure.
Like negotiations and all of those other sorts of things on different scales. You mentioned Antifa as an action arm. We're gonna in the next segment or two, or whenever we get to this in this freewheeling awesome conversation, talk about what I call the Kennedy School stuff, and that's special forces, the Kennedy School, where it's taught to both our forces and forces around the world, governments, as they're falling apart, and what sabotage and auxiliaries and all those kinds of things. But I to hear a term like the action arm, Antifa's the action arm, is pretty cool. Well, let's see, shadow government, you mentioned that. You and I know what it means, and I think a lot of people who've read the books know what it means. Give some examples of what a shadow government looks like, because I see that being the future in the United States, whether it's a shadow government run by a gang or now I'm going to not try and be funny and play on words, a shadow government run by the government, and which could be a thing too. So what are shadow governments? What are some examples? Paint some pictures.
Well, a very basic example could be, the version of the mafia, where obviously they're not politically elected, but they're still enforcing their will and extorting people and doing, you know, whatever you think the mafia does, strong arming people and basically controlling an area without being elected, you know. So that would be one way to look at it. Another way, it could be a president that leaves office and then decides not to really leave and tries to steer things to meet his agenda, even though he's no longer elected. It could be something like that. So there's a lot of different ways you can look at it.
Yeah, and one of the ways I tried to show people what at least my concept of this was how Pierce Point operated. It was a shadow government where there was no legitimacy. There was no officiality. I make up words, Ted, quite a bit. and how it got stuff done. And it was, as I described it in the books, the Patriot way. And that was something that the Patriots, Hearts and Minds, which we'll be talking about in a moment, because that's a core Special Forces concept. You guys invented it and have perfected it. But showing people that if you want electricity or drinking water, it's not, hey, you need to sign this oath and be part of our team, or we're going to let your kids die of thirst. It was nothing like that. It was more just our way works. Please join us. Please enjoy the benefits of being on our side. And that's shadow governments. We have them in Lebanon. Hezbollah, it has no actual authority in Lebanon, but runs the southern two-thirds of Lebanon, all over the place. In Afghanistan, you mentioned the tribes. They really run stuff. I mean, you need permission or whatever to marry somebody. Don't even bother going to Kabul and doing a marriage certificate. It's, you know, tribal elder.
Absolutely.
Yeah, shadow governments and tribalism sort of go hand in hand, it seems like. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen when people get desperate, when people are hungry, tired, stressed out.
Well, I can go from a couple different angles. I can go from the angle of just watching U.S. servicemen. And when they get in stressful situations, and, you know, regardless of the level of education that people have, you know, people still have to go to the bare bones necessity at times. And, you know, whether it's, you know, just wanting to live, and, you know, some people will, you know, in a gunfight, some people will definitely rise to the occasion, and other people will, you know, try to save themselves by hiding. And I'm not saying I've seen Green Berets do that, but I've seen other soldiers that weren't part of Special Forces definitely cower in battle. And and these are American soldiers. Think about what could happen to an untrained civilian. Definitely go wrong very quickly. But other things, I mean, look at Venezuela and how you know, people are selling, women are selling themselves, selling their children, whatever, just to get a meal, or you know, just to get by. When people no longer have food, or their common daily luxuries that we have today, I believe that the thin veneer of society is going to wear away very quickly, and it's going to be brutal. I would say, you know, people within the first couple of weeks of not truly being hungry, not having food, and being scared, people are going to do things they would normally never do, and it's frightening to think that Americans would do that, but they would definitely do that if push came to shove, I believe.
Yeah, that's one of the things. Thin veneer of society, and so many folks out there have this normalcy bias that people are going to follow all these rules when they won't. And they need to hear from somebody like you who has seen stuff go horribly wrong. Well, we are at the end of segment one here on the regular show. We're going to take a pause and hear from some folks and come right on back, and we'll pick it up with the real Special Forces Ted.
We'll be right back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate right after this.
PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Looking to meet other like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own prepper group? Already have a group? Join PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet has gathered the biggest names in the industry to help unite preppers everywhere. Join John Jacob Schmidt, Scott Hunt, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, Glenn Tate, Shelby Gallagher, Charlie Hogwood, Samuel Culper, Survivor Jane, Rick Austin, Franklin Horton, Ryan Mitchell, and Brian Duff. Our team is united. Check us out at PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. PrepperNet.com.
And we're back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
And we are back with part two of our regular show with Special Forces Ted. Ted, we're talking about unconventional warfare, Special Forces role in that. Can you just let folks know what it is? Because I think a lot of people think Special Forces just do, you know, blown up bridges, or they wear suits and they speak funny languages, and they, like, you know, the TV stuff. They bust into a bank and they, you know, all that crazy stuff. Heaven forbid they really think that Special Forces is the A-team from the, you know, the 80s TV show, which I guess they did in the 2000s also. What is unconventional warfare and what does special forces really do?
Well, I guess the best way to explain this is unconventional warfare in a nutshell is we would find a country that had a desire or the elements of a resistance already in place, you know, under an oppressive regime or a country that just is ripe for unconventional warfare, whether there's already an insurgency taking place or a resistance movement that is being built up. Basically, SF teams would go in to an area, make contact with these local resistance, you know, groups, guerrilla groups, however you want to call them, recruit, train, and conduct operations with these people to help ultimately meet both of our goals, which would be overthrowing that government. And that's pretty much what unconventional warfare is in a very quick snapshot nutshell.
So no tanks, no airplanes, no naval bombardment. It's unconventional.
Right. So all that stuff, tanks, airplanes, all that stuff, that comes into play later on. And that's definitely part of warfare, but that's more like transcending into conventional warfare then. Okay. And that's a place and time where you hand over your guerrilla forces to over to conventional armies, move in and start doing their thing. And basically, UW would be the best way to prep the area before a conventional force would move into an area. You know, case in point, Afghanistan 2001. You know, SF teams from 5th Group linked up with warlords from, you know, throughout the mountainous regions of Afghanistan, conducted offensive operations against the Taliban and essentially overthrew the Afghani government within 4 months. And that's, you know, that's how it worked. It was pretty textbook, actually, how it went down. Ideally, you'd have more time to, you know, to really build things up. But, unconventional warfare is not traditionally force-on-force combat. It's information operations, it's subversion, it's sabotage, it's raids on soft targets, stuff like that, to basically give the opposing force, the existing government, whoever it is that we're attacking, to soften their, you know, their desire to fight or to destroy their will to fight before the actual big war comes, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. And tell folks about the Jedburghs in World War II and where you all started, because it really defines you guys.
Yeah, and that's really where the big divide came was after the OSS split after World War II, and then the CIA was set up, and shortly thereafter, so was U.S. Army Special Forces. And both of us derive our lineage from the OSS and the Jedburghs. And, you know, Jedburghs would do that exactly. They would link up with resistance forces in France and, you know, throughout Western Europe and, you know, train people how to be saboteurs, train people how to make propaganda, stuff like that, and really affect the battlefield before it was a battlefield, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it sure does. And you mentioned information warfare and everything, and you can tell from the 299 Days series that I am a civil affairs guy wannabe, right? Mm-hmm. You can just tell, you know, how Pierce Point is providing all these services. So you've got your trigger pullers, your A-teams and your explosives dudes. I don't think people understand the role of civil affairs and psychological operations and all of those other folks in your mission. Describe that, because I see a lot of parallels between civil affairs, information, warfare, in a post-collapse or even a during the collapse. Describe that.
So depending on, you know, what the catalyst of the collapse is, you know, civil affairs may not come into play until after or maybe happen during. But psychological operations, that's something that needs to come hand in hand with unconventional warfare at the earliest stages. And that's really maybe not necessarily overtly saying, hey, your government's bad and this is why, but you know, just slightly pointing out, you know, little chinks in the armor of the government without blatantly saying it, just planting those seeds with the local population to give doubt of the current regime. And as it continues to build on, you can be a little more overt about it as time goes on until you're, you know, straight up calling out the government for what they're doing. But just casting seeds of doubt, you know, in the local populace. If you control the population, you will win an insurgency. That's all there is to it. And, you know, hearts and minds really go a long way. You hit the nail on the head when you came to, you know, building the community in Pierce Point and all that. That was spot on as far as, you know, UW goes, is, you know, building villages and all that stuff. It was remarkable how you did that.
It was funny. A friend of mine who's a former ranger and a private military contractor, he called me and he said he read it. He read a draft of it. He's one of my advisors. And he said, seriously, like, you say you haven't been in the military. Seriously, you know, which group? I mean, come on. You're obvious. I was like, are you kidding? And at first I laughed. And I was like, yeah, that's funny. I'm this suburban lawyer guy, right? I mean, and I listened to him and he said, no, you got it. And I said, I don't know. I don't have any special skills. I said, this just makes sense. I mean, if you were going to replace a corrupt government with a functioning government, this is how you would do it. I mean, this is just practical. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that, because very few people who meet me in real life confuse me with Green Beret. So let's see, there's that. And then the civil affairs part, of course, you mentioned afterwards, that's just making sure that, you know, the electricity's on and that people have the basic infrastructure. I mean, sometimes it gets down to being the electric company, right? I mean, it's not very glamorous. I know some civil affairs guys in First Group, and they're always laughing about how they don't have the cool, you know, jobs. But I actually think the population having electricity and you, the good guys, providing the electricity to the population, that's what really matters. Let's be honest. It's all politics.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, so what are some other parts of unconventional warfare that Special Forces teams go do?
So, I mean, everything is through buying with your indigenous force. And like I was saying before, it could be anything from interdicting soft targets to developing a local area network to support your UW operations. Just to be clear, you're not just going to have your guerrilla force or your action arm and think you're gonna, you know, win the war and save the day. Very little things actually get accomplished, you know, by just killing people alone. You have to have a message behind it and a purpose behind what you're doing and why you're doing it. And if it's to degrade an enemy capability or to, you know, set something up for a future attack, then that's fine. But you also have to spend the time, build your auxiliary and your underground and your network within that area to really be successful. And a lot of that can be very, you know, non-sexy combat type roles, you know, more like making sure that, you know, the locals have a means to communicate with each other so they can communicate with you, you know, locals like you in the area, because obviously if they know you're in the area and they don't like you, they're going to turn you in. So all of those things are extremely relevant when trying to operate in denied areas and trying to you know, get the population on your side to meet that common goal.
So you've brought up three golden terms, each one of which is an hour-long show in and of itself. So talk some more about hearts and minds. The second one is the underground, and the third one is the auxiliary. Because there's some meaty stuff for folks listening to this. You want to understand how to make it through this collapse and in an organized, you know, practical fashion. Hearts and minds, the underground and the auxiliary are three things you need to be thinking about.
So the way to look at auxiliary, underground, guerrilla force, depending on, you know, who you are and what your background is, you can relate it to certain things. For me, the easiest way I think of it is you have your guerrilla force would be, you know, like your platoon or your company of infantry guys. Your underground would be your direct support enablers, whether it's military intelligence, you know, combat engineers, stuff like that, people who could directly affect the battlefield with a non-kinetic means, via sabotage or psychological operations or whatever. And then you have your auxiliary, which is really your support, your service and support role, which would be, people who would drive you around the area, people that would get you food, people who could supply you with ammunition or, whatever it may be. And, logistics is huge. If you don't have a good logistical chain, obviously you can't rely just on aerial resupplies alone. That's not going to work every time. So if you can build up a network where you're self-sustaining, especially in a collapse environment where you're not falling under, a government, if you will, you need to be able to be self-sustaining with your network and be able to provide for each other to meet your common goals.
Right, and you have to have these underground and auxiliary things, because I think a lot of preppers, especially men going into this, they love the trigger pulling stuff, and they love getting on Instagram and showing everybody the $400 trigger they just got for their seventh AR. And I mean, let's be honest, that's, having a network of people who are going to be able to communicate with you and say, hey, the bad guys just moved into the next neighborhood. I thought you might want to know. You didn't hear it from me. That's way more important than that millisecond difference on your seventh AR that just got stolen by the gang that's down the road because you didn't have a network out there. Describe, you talked about auxiliaries and guerrillas and everything. This sounds a lot to me, and I'm putting you on the spot, a lot of Mao's theories on guerrilla warfare. And I have an uneducated, ignorant theory. So at least I'm honest, right? Right at the end. And I look at what George Washington did, and obviously he had help. There was the Swamp Fox and other folks, but the Continental Army, the Revolutionary Army, I think there are tons of commonalities between how the Americans did it in the Revolutionary War and what Mao talked about. So can you talk about Mao's theories about guerrilla warfare, the fish swimming in the sea and all that sort of stuff, and then maybe agree or disagree. It's fine if you disagree, because you know more about this than I do, with whether the Revolutionary War scenario that we all know about, because we all read about in history books, picking off redcoats with snipers and stuff like that. Are there similarities between Mao and George Washington?
Absolutely. I think that any resistance or insurgency, whatever you want to call it, the smaller force or the little guy going up against the big guy, if you think you're going to attack the big army, head to head, you're sadly mistaken. Obviously, you're going to be crushed on the battlefield. And that's why it's so important to, at least in the initial stages, especially, fight in the shadows. Never commit to a decisive engagement. The tactics that George Washington and the Continentals used is quite similar to, the early days of Vietnam and, against the French and against the Americans. A lot of deception, information operation, having the insurgents live amongst the population and strike only when they can be successful, and that's the key. And that's we saw it in Iraq, we saw it in Afghanistan. It's very. I think there's certain basic truths to any insurgency that if you follow the recipe correctly, you're going to you're going to see things like sabotage of certain facilities that, support the local government, or indirect attack on a satellite tower or a factory or whatever it is, or a supply train that could, help your, that would support the local government, but you're degrading their capability. And that's exactly, what George Washington was doing, what Mao was doing, fighting in the shadows and, making their size and their capabilities an advantage instead of a disadvantage.
And what is standard SF doctrine about atrocities? And by that I mean, I think some preppers out there, and they might be reading too much sort of comic book prepper fiction, and they think it's a great idea to go and commit atrocities. I obviously don't. Tell us about the theory, the doctrine behind atrocities? Should your side commit them or not?
So obviously, in the United States government, the war of law of land warfare is followed, you know, completely, no questions asked. Yeah, we're not allowed to, you know, conduct or commit any atrocities. And if a partner force is doing that, we need to report it up. That's black and white. There's no, you know, there's no middle ground there. With that said, you know, you're going to have rogue elements possibly commit atrocities because of emotions or whatever, and you need to let them know that that's not the right way to do things and that you'll lose the support of the population if you do stuff like that. And you need to steer them and educate your guerrilla force or whoever it is why you don't do that, so that you can be more successful in your operation. But yeah, you know, it's nothing glamorous. It's nothing that you know, people read about this in some prepper fiction and think it's a huge mistake. I definitely would not subscribe to any type of atrocities, and people that I work with would not either.
And I know it can be hard on you guys, career wise, it's actually not hard on you, but you might think it is to say, hey, partner force, you can't do this. But you guys have made it clear that it is within the special forces community the right thing to do. And the career mistake would be allowing some local partner force to go, you know, kill a bunch of women and children. Tell us something. A lot of people hear this term A-team and they go, oh yeah, the A-team, that's like George Peppard and there was Mr. T, and they had mini 14s with folding stocks, which are garbage. And they had a really cool van, and they don't really know what an A-team is. So there's A-teams and B-teams, I believe, and maybe even C-teams. Mm-hmm. What are those? And then within A-teams, what are the 18, you know, classifications, you know, 18 A, B, C, not like memorizing what the classification is, but like what skills does an A-team have? Let's start with that question.
Sure. No, yeah, absolutely. So an A-team, or more recently known as ODA, Operational Detachment Alpha, is basically the core nucleus of any special forces unit. And that is the team that would infiltrate an area to conduct unconventional warfare, or, you know, whatever their mission is for that, you know, for that deployment. And it has a lot of redundancies built in so that they can sustain split team operations and also train up to a battalion's worth of people if necessary. So starting off, we have a 18 Alpha, which is the team leader. He's a captain. Then we have a 180 Alpha, which is the assistant team leader, which is that's a W1 or W2.
Warrant officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, warrant officer one, warrant officer two, who came up through the ranks of special forces and then decided to go to the warrant officer course. It's not like we take a pilot and say, okay, now you're second in command of an A team. That's not what we do. But
it happens on TV. Come on. Remember that JAG show where a naval aviator was also like a SEAL? Come on.
I must have missed that one. Yeah. But yeah, they come up within the community and then eventually become the 2IC of, you know, the team. On top of that, then we'll have the 18 Zulu, which is the team sergeant. Usually the team sergeant has one or two prior SF MOSs or skill sets before he becomes a team sergeant. And then you have his counterpart, which would be the 18 Fox, and he's the assistant operations / intelligence sergeant for the team. And if you go into split team operations, he would be the acting team sergeant for the other half of the team. Then you're going to have two weapons guys, two engineers, two combo guys, and two medics per team. And each one will have a junior and a senior per section. And each section, that they'll have a variety of skill sets within their trade. And then there's also Special Forces core skill sets that anyone can have. Like, you can have a medic and a weapons guy both be snipers. That doesn't matter. You know, but maybe for advanced trauma, you might only have the medic who's trained in it, then he cross-trains the rest of the team in advanced trauma, if that makes sense.
And how many lawyers does a typical ODA have?
Well, you'd be surprised. I have come across one or two lawyers that are on ODAs nowadays. Yeah, absolutely.
They've ruined it, I guess, right? I mean, if they're there, that's like, no, you can't do this. No, you can't do that.
Yeah, they're not allowed to talk.
Good. That's
no,
that's
reason.
No. No, but I mean, are they JAG officers that are in there in a there to give advice, or are they just like they were lawyers in another life and now they're medics?
Right. They're people that were lawyers in another life and now they're medics or combo guys or engineers, you know, whatever they were chosen to do. But yeah, you know, on the C team, like you asked about, you know, at the battalion level, yeah, you may have a JAG officer assigned to the battalion or definitely at the group level. And, you know, they can advise you on rules of engagement, stuff like that, different things within certain countries before you go, or if something occurs in country, they can help you out while you're there. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely logistical, you know, lawyers in place up at, you know, the C team level that would do stuff like that. And just to briefly touch on the B team, since you mentioned it, the B team is basically the company, it's the company headshed. So for every SF company, you're going to have six. Right now there's six teams in every company that can change. When I first got to group, there was five, and then they grew a sixth team. And I've heard even in the 90s, it was down to four teams. So it all depends on, you know, how they want to fund and support SF. But right now, yeah, you have roughly six teams per company and six A teams and then one B team. That B team is they're tasked with overall administrative roles within the company. And, you know, they're just members of A teams that get picked and pulled up to the B team to pull a staff function for a year or whatever. It's not like they're a different MOS or you know, a non-SF skill set. They just get pulled away to work their staff function. And just to kind of spell it out, so every MOS or job on the team, they have
an MOS, just to interrupt, MOS is like whatever, it's military occupation specialty or something. It's like a digit and some two digits and a letter, and it's like your job. If you're a JAG officer, you're a like 92B. I'm making that up or something like that, right? That's
right.
What that is.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Well, no, you're exactly right. And just to kind of spell it out, so say the weapons sergeant on the team, he's the 18 Bravo. Well, his administrative task would be, you know, planning operations as far as like running ranges and, you know, ordering ammo and stuff like that. And like the 18 Delta on the team, he's the admin guy. He's the S1. So he would make sure everyone's shot records are up, make sure that, you know, people's life insurance is up to date and stuff like that. And so when you get pulled up to the B team, you're just doing that on a larger scale. But yeah, every team is definitely self-contained and basically handles all of its business internally and then sends their status up to the B team for the B team to, you know, process it and send it up to the C team or whatever the case may be.
Right. And then I knew a guy at JBLM, he was in group, and he was not a long tabber, meaning no special forces tab. He wasn't an A-team guy. He was the guy who went in when you guys would hit a place, he would grab all the hard drives and all the stuff and start copying stuff. He was basically the evidence technician who carried an MP5. And so there are some, you know, I'm guessing, some unique little specialties that attach to some of the stuff you guys do.
So this guy you're talking about, he's a support guy. He probably had some other, you know, regular Army support MOS that wasn't actively being used. He could have been a chemical guy or a parachute rigger. It all depends. You know, he could just some support task that wasn't being used. So he was probably trained up by 18 Fox on a team to, because usually it's 18 Fox who handles on the intelligence on target. So he's probably trained up by an 18 Fox. Hey, this is how I want you to package this stuff up so we can send it up to hire. And, you know, that was his role then. You know, it wasn't necessarily his MOS or his, you know, assigned duty in the military, but he was tasked that, you know, just as an enabler, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And we have about five more minutes in this segment. One of the other members of an A team. And the reason I think this matters to preppers is that it gives you an idea about how to organize your dudes. And that's the whole point of this. I mean, there are tons of podcasts out there about the details of special operations stuff. Soft Rep is a really good podcast on that, by the way. We're relating all this back to preppers. One of the things that preppers will not have on one of these teams would be a JTAC or a TAC. That's a Joint Terminal Air Control Party. Basically, the guys that call in airstrikes, they used to be combat controllers. They're in the Air Force. And then TACPs, they call in airstrikes on conventional stuff. Do you sometimes have one of those guys around?
So the answer is yes. And we have those internally on the team. And then we also sometimes will get augmentees from different parts of the military that are, you know, like Air Force combat controllers that come over and be our JTACs for a mission or something along those lines. But that's one of those additional skill sets that anyone on an SFODA can possess. You know, you can be a weapons sergeant or an engineer and go to the JTAC course and, you know, literally call in bombs on the enemy with the training that you get. And you're just, you know, you're an SF guy, but that's one of your additional duties.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's good. That's a lot of stuff about special forces and what you do. I hope folks out there are realizing that they can take some lessons for how special forces teams are organized and the skills they have, because you guys have been doing this for like 70, 80 years. I don't know, you know, you guys have perfected this. I mean, this isn't like some brilliant general's idea on some org chart. This is what works. And you, Special Forces Ted, have actually carried it out. What are some, and we have about 3 minutes in this segment. Then we'll go in the after show. We got some really good stuff in the after show for Patreon supporters. What are some things you've seen that work particularly well and some things that don't work particularly well when it comes to an A team? I mean, you know, what works and what doesn't with this structure?
So being a self-sustaining team, it definitely does that well. As far as, like, you know, you have your medics already in-house, you have your combo guys, you have your engineers who can get your camp up and running and make sure that logistically everything is flowing to your camp. You have your weapons guys to set up perimeter defense, working with engineers. All of that works really well. Redundancy is very important, and so is cross-training. And one thing that I've noticed lately is not that cross-training is lacking, but there needs to be more of it. It needs to be more pushed to the forefront. Just because you're the medic, you still need to know how to set up the mortar tube. And just because you're the weapons guy, you need to know how to put in a chest tube, you know, stuff like that. It's not just because very easily, you know, both your medics could be shot on mission, or very easily you could be going on a raid or trying to set up your mortars, and next thing you know, your weapons guy is out of the fight for whatever reason. So everyone needs to cross-train as much as possible, be able to work the radios, be able to operate the weapons, and be able to save lives as much as possible. That way they can cover down on each other.
And that's a message for preppers out there. You just heard it from a Green Beret. You have to cross-train. You have to know a little bit about all these different things, because you're going to be in who knows what kind of situation. And you might be the one on the radio, or you might be the medic, or all those other things. Well, we're coming to the end of this segment. Ted, what are some last thoughts you have for preppers out there?
Just stay vigilant, guys. Stay prepared, and don't let your guard down. I don't think that we're in the clear yet at all. So definitely stay vigilant for yourselves and for your families. And thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, we'll have you on the after show here in a moment. And he's right. You got to, preppers out there, you've got to stay vigilant. You've got to apply some of these concepts. You don't need to be a Green Beret to know that an auxiliary is a really good idea. And take that idea of an auxiliary and apply it. Close your eyes and think about what in your neighborhood, situation, friend group, whatever, who would be some auxiliary people? Who would be some underground people? You probably know who the trigger pullers are, because it's probably you, and that's why you're listening to this show. So think these things out, apply them. So we're going to go out and come back to the after show. But if you're not a Patreon subscriber, this will be the end of this episode. Thank you, Special Forces Ted, for coming on. We know you're a busy guy, and it was much appreciated. You gave a lot of information out.
You've been listening to Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate. All of the fun and easy prepping information heard on this podcast can be found online at prepping2-0.com. You can also find out more about Glenn's books online at 299days.com and about Shelby's books online at agreatstate.com. Until next time, be smart, be safe, and be prepared.